Hello, everybody. Konnichiwa. This is Lisa DeLay, and you are listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today is Soul School Lesson 81, Motivation and Human Consciousness. Before I get into that, I want to inform you that today is the mid-episode, the in-between episode of Theopoetics Part 1 and Theopoetics Part 2. Last week, I spoke with Callie Keith Perry, and we went over what is Theopoetics, what does that entail, and how that can be used to talk about things beyond propositional theology. It's an embodied way to speak about things that are beyond words and involve art and imagination and embodying something that can be a rich form of communication. I've listened to it myself several times, and I urge you to go back and listen to it if you haven't, or maybe even just listen to it again. And then after this episode, in 1 week, you will hear part two with my guest, Michael Wright. And we will actually go over three different artists, three different creators, a poet and two installation artists that have done things that are very theopoetic. And we will discuss their artwork or the poetry, and we will go into details about what is so life-giving about this, what is so profound about these pieces. And I think you are going to really love this second piece, this second part to the Theopoetics series that I'm doing. Very short series, just two parts, but I really enjoyed making these two, and I think you'll really enjoy it too. Especially if you create things or if you communicate things. It's a way to interact on a different level with a different kind of richness and foundation where you can offer something to the world that is much more full-bodied, hopefully. Now, today we're going to be talking about consciousness in a way that maybe you haven't considered before. I came across an article that I will include in the show notes that was very helpful for me to bring up these topics in a richer light. And I'm reflecting somewhat on that, but then I'm riffing off on some of my own things as well. There are three main ways to understand consciousness. There might be some subcategories here, or maybe some other outlier examples of other theories, but mainly people have, over the centuries, over the millennia, have come up with three ways to understand what is different about human consciousness as opposed to animal consciousness. Things like dogs and primates and cats, and how they understand and reflect in the world or don't, and how they plan things, how they are motivated. Humans are really distinct in how they can come out of their circumstances and reflect back in on them, how they can understand things that they've done or plan in the future, and kind of, in a sense, come into almost a third person perspective, an omniscient sort of perspective, and look back in on their world. It's a really unique quality of humans, and it seems light years ahead of what animals, even primates, other primates like chimps, can do. Although chimps have the ability to recognize themselves in the mirror, they don't seem to have these ideas. Like a chimp troop can seem to work together and cooperate, but they're not going to build a hospital or plan something for the future in the way anywhere near humans would. They don't make artwork and music and things for posterity, things like that, in any sorts of ways that humans naturally do. Even young children will do these things that are light years ahead of animals. And humans seem to have always wanted to understand why that is. And understanding why we are what we are and reflecting on that and being constantly curious about it is also a human quality as well. And this has gone on, as we can tell, in the writing and in the artifacts of humans, in the artwork, that humans have been always preoccupied with what makes us human, what is going on here. And magic and spiritual significance has been given to this. Mythology is behind it. And all sorts of reasons are attributed to why this is. And so we'll dig into that a little bit. So the number one example, the first example I'm going to give you is for consciousness and a way to understand it is a duality kind of consciousness. So that type says that there's a body And in your body is housed a spirit soul kind of thing. And this spirit soul gives you consciousness. And this is a very common idea of what consciousness is. And then when you die, your body goes into the ground, goes back to the earth, and away your spirit soul goes up to heaven or back to Brahma or God. And there's this dual nature of you. There's the physical nature, and then there's the soul nature, and you're separated and you're joined in the body for a period of time on earth. It's a really common, very ancient notion about how consciousness works. The body is this sort of shell. We're a ghost in the shell, and this must be how consciousness works. Now, that's a really common notion, and you know, these things are obviously hard to prove. People have like out of body experiences too, and they'll say, you know, I left my body. I was looking down on my body. That seems to prove duality of spirit body. But in tests in neuroscience, in tests in brain science, they're also able to, while a person's waking, because the brain itself doesn't have any nerve tissue for pain in the actual brain, they're able to stimulate parts of the brain and recreate that out-of-body experience where a person feels when they're stimulated in a certain part of the brain, they have the exact sensation of being out of their body looking down on themselves. It appears that there's a part of the brain that can be acted upon or stimulated that will give that exact same sensation, that there I am looking down on myself, I can see everything. And why that is up for debate. People debate why that is, whether it's a material reason only or whether it's part of how this body spirit thing is cohesive. So I won't get into that. It's out of my realm of expertise, but I'm just that first notion. The second notion is a purely material one. So this doesn't have any tie into the spirituality aspect or the soul aspect or any kind of religious or magical aspect. And that is that your brain is the only way to understand things, and consciousness happens when there's enough neural connections to offer you the chance to loop around, be able to understand and reflect on yourself. So it's more and more loops of neural networking that allow your brain to know itself and understand itself. We see this a little bit reflected in insects. You will see insects are sort of like pre-programmed to do certain things and only certain things, and they can't vary out of those things. But as the brain gets more complex in animals, you will see that they're not just responding to stimuli, but they are able to maybe plan ahead in certain aspects, but they do seem to still be on sort of a program. And then as the brain gets more and more complex in dolphins and elephants and chimps, they are able to have a lot of social aspects to them where they can bond together socially, where they can grieve and mourn and do death rituals for their lost loved ones. And they can remember, and when they encounter bones of their lost loved ones, they can show all the signs of mourning and grief. It's remarkable, this ability, as the brain gets more complex, to just have the ability to seem to reflect in on itself. And so that is a second theory, that it begins and ends with the brain. When the brain stops functioning, that consciousness ends with the physical cessation of brain function. So consciousness begins and ends with the living brain tissue. This, of course, is popular with materialists, with scientists who don't have any maybe respect or understanding of spirituality and religion, or just feel like there is just not enough evidence to merit connecting the two. And they would feel that anything aside from the material is basically an illusion that we have to make ourselves feel better or to add meaning and to comfort ourselves because we fear death. In some ways, this makes a lot of sense to me, and I can understand why this would be a compelling argument. And in my own journey of deconstruction, reconstruction, trying to understand the world, I feel like, well, you know, everything I understand about the world is something I've interpreted through my brain, through my actual brain. If my brain was destroyed, what would I know? When someone gets into a severe accident, their brain goes, their personality goes, and their memory goes, and they are not themselves. So what is left but a person who's just lying there? And that was the case with my father, who was severely impaired by what was somewhat of a brainstem sort of stroke. He was in nursing care for about 11 years, and he wasn't himself. He was gone. But his body was there, and it was functioning. But was he conscious? Very difficult to say that he was conscious. There was no real brain activity. It's difficult to say. Playing off of that, even though there's some compelling evidence for the strictly material view of consciousness, it also seems like there's some pieces missing to that. It doesn't seem 100% satisfying that that's it. Once the brain's gone, everything's gone. There's almost too much consciousness to validate this type of purely material view. There are so many people who are connected on a deeper level that there almost seems to be something more going on. And I think people who are purely materialistic still often don't find that 100% satisfying, even though it sort of makes sense on the surface. They are also enchanted with wonder and seem to be tapped into something else too that is sort of out there. There's this searching for something more, and this something that seems to connect us all on some deeper level. And so there's a third really interesting notion of consciousness, and it's that more or less that there is no duality, and that consciousness actually precedes matter. And that is to say that consciousness is this sort of undergirding of this stuff that isn't really measurable or that we can grasp, that is preceding matter, and that everything actually is conscious at some really, really deep level that we can't even understand. And so the brain is then acting as an antenna somehow to tune into this, and that when we feel connection with others in this really powerful sort of fundamental way, we're both tapping into this sort of frequency, you could say. Now, this might sound a little woo, a little weird, but tons and tons of spiritual and religious traditions have understood this too. In Buddhism, in mysticism of all stripes, of all different religions, have a mystical contemplative stream to them. That means every religion actually has this at the roots of their religion. This is experiential, what you would say, like experiential touch with the divine, that it's almost like we're tuning in to something and we're experiencing the divine, which you might say is like revelation or something that you can't even explain. It's just something that's been experienced, almost like we've sort of tuned into a channel, and we didn't have a way to do that ourselves. It just sort of happened. That obviously is difficult to prove, but there are some science moving towards that right now. And I will have a link to this article that talks just about that very thing if you want to dig in deeper, because this is fascinating stuff. Anyways, it is to me, especially once science gets involved and says, you know, there could be something deeper than the material that we've noticed up until now. There could be something that we call consciousness that could be at a root level. I mean, let's face it, we didn't know a thing about dark matter, and it turns out dark matter is a huge big deal, and it makes up most of the universe. We just discovered it. So the fact that maybe consciousness, or what we call consciousness, could be at the core of all things, this kind of God particle, or what have you, wouldn't terribly surprise me. And so this brings us to talking about motivation. Consciousness and motivation are completely interlinked, because our ability to reflect on what we're doing or what we have done will motivate our behaviors and our actions for the future or for the present. Because we might think, oh, I really regret doing what I did before. That had all these negative effects on me or people around me. And as I reflect on that and I think about how I felt and what the consequences were, I'm going to change how I do things. And our ability to go back and assess and reflect, being this human trait, plays so much into how we interact with each other and maybe how we worship or maybe how we move forward in our lives. So I want to reflect on motivation as it relates to consciousness. Now, in the duality model of spirit and body, there have been a lot of ideas about what motivates us and what influences us. For instance, in religious terms and religious traditions, there have been the ideas that we're motivated by spirits, demons maybe, angels, and that these influences come in and try to vie for our attention and influence us. And that we also can be affected by these positive or negative influences, or maybe our flesh, as it says in the Bible, the New Testament especially, our flesh can be this negative influence that is bent to sin, and this duality, you know, is in a war and a fighting war and a fighting nature as to what's going to happen in the future, how we're going to be motivated or make our decisions. And there's kind of this push and pull with this duality. Now, if you go to the material notion of how we're motivated, this has a lot to do with stimuli and nature and nurture. And it's also a kind of warring as well, but in very different ways. It's not chalked up to magical things or spiritual things or the unseen world. It's in those senses of spirits, but it's definitely chalked up to culture and influences and trauma and DNA and genes and things like that. And there's only so much control we can have over some of those things, and other things can be reshaped possibly with new influences or new ways of training yourself. Cognitive behavioral therapy can help in those instances. And that's in a way how motivation can be harnessed or shaped, but in that notion of how consciousness works in the material only. And then the notion that consciousness precedes matter, and that we're tapping into something else, and that we're all actually one, that the brain is this antenna tapping into something else, but that there actually is no separation of body and spirit and soul, that even the body is also made up at the core of itself, is made up of this consciousness matter. We've just been unaware of it. Once you start off with that, everything is at its root, at its actual atomic level, somehow consciousness is in some way like this core particle, if you will, and this non-dualistic thinking about it, things break down in an entirely different way. You wind up realizing that there's, for instance, you could be motivated and peel back the layers of consciousness, in a sense, in your mind. So this is kind of a contemplative way of thinking about motivation and things like that. So let me explain a little bit here, try to explain this. So you can kind of look into your inner world. You can kind of come up to this omniscient view and look back in and think, what am I thinking about in my interior world? What's going on in there? In a way, you're saying, I'm going to quiet down and I'm going to kind of pull back and look back in. What's in there? That's a really neat human ability to be able to like look back in. Now, no view of yourself is going to be 100% objective. You've goggles on, you're tainted. But in a sense, the ability to stop and look around inside and look for the good, the bad, and the ugly is remarkable. And as you practice it more and more, you get better and better at it. This helps also with a spiritual guide, a spiritual director, or a trusted friend who can be honest with you and loving at the same time. And you can speak about these things with your friend and say, here's, you know, journal and start really looking inside. What are some problem areas? What are some things I'm good at? And start reflecting. What are your motivations and things? Is it fear? A lot of times that's it. Is it fear? Is it, you know, what are the different insecurities that have improperly motivated you? And you can start peeling back some of the layers of your inner world. And what you find out often is the thing that has been labeled the ego by Freud. It's just a label. It doesn't actually exist. It's kind of a loop of consciousness. And this ego that you have, it helps preserve you in the world. It helps you thrive and survive in the world, to get safety and food, procreate and to get along in the world. And it chatters all the time. It's this constant chatter. From a contemplative view, this isn't your true self. This is kind of the operating system or something, the software that's running ahead, but the core of you is something else. This is kind of a chatter filter, a chatter kind of thing happening, and your ego's chattering all the time, but you can quiet it down as you reflect and come into silence, and you realize that that's not the core piece. That chatter you hear all the time isn't actually the real you. There's something below that, the authentic self, as some people call it in contemplative tradition. The authentic self is below that chatter. And that chatter, realizing that that chatter is very affected by insult, is very affected and threatened easily by envy, by jealousy, by fear. And that ego that's chattering along can be quieted down and disciplined. And you can stick to a more core center. In this non-dual idea of consciousness, you realize that consciousness is actually very, very quiet. It's inside. It's, in Christian terminology, it's where God resides. It's the home. And you come to a homecoming within where God resides. That's Christian language. But in fact, all the other rich traditions of all the major faiths of the world have this in common, that there's this core part of you that is calm in the center, who is this core consciousness, if you will, this core center that is the real thing. It is quite remarkable. I'm going to shift gears a little bit here and talk about an origin story that helps us understand some of how we interrelate as humans and some of how we think. Most people groups have origin stories and they have myth stories. Maybe they're partially true. Maybe they're used as a teaching tool to help the young understand how people work and how to navigate in the world. And this is really important as you bring up children in a culture, in a unique culture, in a unique people group, to make sure that they understand maybe their history, but more so, how are you reacting and acting in the world, and what is motivating you, and what's going to trip you up? In this one particular origin story of humankind, there's a man called the man, and there's a woman called the mother of all. And they are pretty innocent. There's nothing really wrong. Everything's going along just right. And they don't really have the ability to go in and look and reflect on anything they've done because they haven't done anything wrong yet. What happens, though, is that they are able to reflect in on this once they have broken a prohibition, once they have done something that is not allowed. And only then are they able to kind of come outside themselves in an omniscient view, third-person view, and look back in like a narrator might. This origin story shows how different humans are than animals. And so that humans can wonder about why we wonder. And so when things go out of order, humans can think it all through and they can feel deep regret or maybe even shame. And they can feel this interior lack that things have gone wrong, off the rails. I remember when my daughter was born and she loved looking at the world. She was kind of in perpetual awe. Her little mouth was like an O shape, and most of the time she was just looking at her brother playing, looking at the world. She would watch VeggieTales from 3 or 4 months on when her brother would, and she would stay tuned in that whole 20 minutes or so. It was remarkable because she was so young to do that, and I thought for sure she would get distracted and then I'd, you know, play with her or something, but she never would. She would just be glued in, taking in the whole world. And eventually, of course, she learned how to sit up and to walk and everything. And she was a delight, just smiling and playing, and everything was around 18 months to 24 months. She kind of came online. And that means that she started planning and she could plot things out and she could act in her best interest. And she wasn't just observing the world anymore and responding in her world, but she was able to go after things that would benefit her and sometimes be to the detriment of other people, like her brother. She could take something or plot something or do a switcheroo. And I remember when that happened, it happened within a few weeks' time, where she realized that she could set things up in order to benefit herself and sometimes hurt others. Some people would very cynically, I think, say, oh, well, that's when she became a sinner, or that's when she came into her actual nature. For whatever reason, whether you say that she formed enough mental connections in a materialist way, she formed enough neural networks to be able to come online and be conscious, or you say that her sin nature came in and she realized what was good and evil and she could make those decisions, or whether you say that she was finally, her brain was finally tuned as an antenna to pick up and to know the difference, whatever happened, she kind of came online as more fully human than she had ever been and more able to reason. And she could use her powers of humanness and reason for good or for bad. And she had to learn how to harness those things. And she could do either one. She could pick. In a sense, she was given free will, if you will. And we could look at that cynically, or we could look at that as a gift and say, we have the ability to look in on ourselves and in on our lives and in on our own minds and inner worlds and decide the kind of people we want to be and decide what will motivate us, but also what we want to be in the world and who we want to be in the world, the kinds of actions we want to take. And then we can go back and we can look them over at the end of the day and we can say, I did some wrong things and I did some right things. Which things do I want to leave out next time? And that ability to improve ourselves and to create new pathways and to create new ways of being is such a beautiful gift of having the kind of minds we have that I feel so grateful and overjoyed to be human and to be aware that I can be aware and to be aware that I can pass on these ideas to you and you can hear them in your ears right now and you can absorb them into your mind and you could, if you want to, exercise them and practice them in your world. What a remarkable, beautiful thing. So I hope that you'll reflect on what it is to be human in these special ways and reflect on your own motivations. Maybe you have an idea of consciousness that is outside of one of these three areas, or maybe you feel like you know. However you decide how consciousness works, I don't know that we have any real hard proof, but however you decide that works isn't as important as using your faculties of reason and reflection and consciousness to better your life so that the world becomes a better place. I thank you so much for listening. It means so much to me that you would listen and that you would share this program with other people. If you feel like supporting what I do, you can start only a dollar and go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. And when you do that, you get a lot of extras. There are so many things there waiting for you to check out. And I really thank you for all that you've done to make this show successful. I'll see you next week.